Oh, Jerry Jordan, my doctorate is from UCLA. I was a graduate student there in 1963 to 67. I was a research assistant to Carl Bruner. And during that period of time, two accidents happened. One was Milton Friedman took a sabbatical leave from near Chicago and spent a quarter at UCLA and conducted his famous money workshop at a time when I was at the dissertation proposal stage. And Homer Jones, the director of research at the St. Louis Fed, who had been both a teacher of Friedman's and a student of Friedman's, took a sabbatical from the St. Louis Fed and spent 2 months at UCLA so that he could also attend that workshop. So I became acquainted with Homer Jones, and as a result of that, my first job was at the St. Louis Fed in 1967.
It must have been interesting to listen to the dialogue back and forth between Friedman and Jones at that point, since Jones had had so much experience in Washington, in policy.
Yeah, Homer was an agnostic about most economic theory, in fact, agnostic about most things, and constantly questioning, never quite satisfied with either the theoretical foundations of an argument or with the empirical evidence. And Milton, in that sense, was much more disciplined, willing to go with what the evidence suggested at the moment. It was also an interesting period in that Bruner and Meltzer were conducting their investigations as an outgrowth of the targets and indicator conferences. And this was a period of time when the Friedman, Meiselman, Ando, Modigliani, Hester, Mayer, so on, debates were all taking place over the role of money and economic activity. The St. Louis Fed was at that time already publishing money supply statistics that the Board of Governors was still refusing to do. So for a period of time in there, the only source of money supply data was the St. Louis Fed publications, which they collected the raw numbers and did the seasonal adjustments themselves until the Board of Governors finally developed a parallel series.
So St. Louis sort of shamed the board into doing it right.
That's right. They and the same thing later happened with the monetary base. So when I got to St. Louis in 1967, my tasks, in addition to finishing a dissertation, was to continue this Friedman-Meiselman type debate over the empirical evidence about the relationship between money and economic activity, and also to develop the concept of the monetary base as a way of thinking about the thrust of central bank actions and economic activity.
So the Anderson-Jordan model, its intellectual heritage was the Friedman-Meiselman regressions of...
Yeah, we viewed it as simply using the latest techniques, the Almanac regression techniques that had been developed at that time, better computer powers, to empirically test a Friedman-Meiselman type relationship, which became known as reduced form tests.
But you put in the deficit. That was the big thing, and it caused a consternation. You must have been astounded at how much attention your regressions got.
We were pure empiricists at that time, in that we would have a parade of visitors coming through, and we would ask them what measures they looked at to summarize the thrust of both monetary and fiscal policies on economic activity. And they would cite various measures of government spending or tax receipts or deficits, sometimes first differences, sometimes growth rates, and similarly for monetary measures. And we cataloged these plus statements that were in the public record by members of the Open Market Committee, governors and presidents, as to what indicators they looked at to indicate whether policies were expansionary or contractionary. And we simply would punch it into the cards and send it off to the computer to see whether there was any statistical basis for the kind of conception that they claimed that they had when they actually were conducting policy. But it included both real policymakers at the time seizures were, and we simply tested it.
Well, did Anderson have a quantity theory background, or did he come at that after you'd done this work, Leonel Anderson?
Well, Andy Anderson had a fair amount of exposure to monetary analysis by that time, partly because he worked for Homer Jones in St. Louis. But he was a Minnesota student. He had good price theory from Miles Brownlee, but his macroeconomics was Walter Heller. So he had not, before that time, really thought of himself as being a monetarist, but he was a pure empiricist, and he was willing to simply torture the data and see what it confessed. And he became persuaded by the work that we did then, 67, 68, and subsequently published.
Would you be willing to comment on Homer Jones' quantity theory ideas? Did he go back to Irving Fisher, and then he just picked up Clark Warburton and his experience in Washington, and you say an empirical bent and an intellectual curiosity, and he sort of mixed all these things together? I mean, can you classify him as a particular kind of quantity theorist? Or?
Well, he was. The power of the evidence in Homer's mind. He was always still skeptical about any discretionary activist approach to conducting monetary policy to alter outcomes, a very healthy skepticism. It was based on the teachings of not only Irving Fisher, but Herb Simon, Frank H. Knight. He had been a student of Friedman's in his later years, and to some extent also of George Stigler, though that didn't relate as directly to his views on money. Warburton did have a lot of influence on him at that time. He, in the 50s, had not had much success in getting a voice, and it was only after he got to the St. Louis Fed and was starting to attract the staff to really do the work and training a couple of presidents that he was able to find a voice and get some recognition for making a contribution on the way we even thought about monetary policy. It still was in the Bretton Woods gold standard world, and so it was constrained, but Homer saw that the kind of things that were being done in the way of free reserves and these other conceptions of tone and feel, fine-tuning kind of notions, were unscientific. And Homer, if anything, was a scientist.
The bank presidents, Dulles Johns and then Darrell Francis, they were not economists.
Well, Darrell was, and he has a master's degree in ag econ from University of Missouri, and he's up from St. Joseph, Missouri. He had pretty good economic theory coming from ag econ. He understood price theory, and in that period in time, especially, ag econ departments preserved a lot of what we would call microeconomics or relative price theory as a basic part of what they taught. And then the second thing about Darrell Francis was he was essentially a Harry Truman of the Federal Reserve. He was very much a show-me kind of a person, and if you would demonstrate to him, especially some empirical relationships, he was very willing to adopt it and to work with it as this framework.
So he obviously developed a good working relationship with the staff. What about Dulles Johns? Did he work primarily with Homer Jones? And
Johns was before my time.
Okay.
Darrell was the president by the time I got there in 67.
Okay.
I didn't know Johns at all.
Okay.
And there was another one in between. Harry Shuford was in between the two of them for 2.5 or 3 years.
Okay, that I didn't know. So when did you go to the Council on Economic Advisors?
I was the macro member in Reagan's first 2 years, 81 and 82.
Right. But weren't you involved in some staff work in the early 70s at the Council?
Well, yeah, that was a lone kind of thing. Andy did more than I did, but at the time that Nixon took office in January of 69, of course, they inherited Lyndon Johnson's economic staff, and they appointed Paul McCracken, Herb Stein, and Henry Hautacker as the economists, but they didn't have any staff to work with. So Andy Anderson and Elaine Goldstein from our staff went down there pretty much full-time for 6 months, and I did some shuttling back and forth, as did some other members of the staff, Michael Karen on international, Keith Carlson on fiscal, developing high employment budget deficit kind of measures, but trying to provide them with some transition support until they could recruit their own staff.
Did you get involved at all in the forecasting exercises that the council was involved in?
I had quite a few discussions with them at that time because they didn't have any ability on their own to do, I would call them more projections than forecasts, but to set a policy framework in terms of money. We principally used M2 because Paul McCracken was more of an M2 type person, probably still is. Than a narrow money person, didn't have too much confidence or understanding of the monetary base. And by then, Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz had so popularized M2 and its velocity in relationship to nominal GDP that everybody was most comfortable working with that. And so we provided with them with a time path out into the future. I don't remember what the horizon was of what M2 growth should be consistent with, what kind of a nominal GDP growth, and therefore inflation and output.
So we're both McCracken and Stein were sympathetic to your ideas, but you wouldn't call either one a quantity theorist, would you? McCracken was more of a business economist, and Stein had kind of made his fame, writing the book on fiscal policy and advising the CED. So neither of them came out of the Friedman School, but they were.
But Herb was not hostile to monetary analysis, and Paul was fairly sympathetic. I think that was partly the environment of the time with George Shultz at the OMB. At that point, he was probably at Labor.
Right.
He was in and around there.
He went to OMB in the summer of 1970.
Yeah, and then Milton Friedman had a good relationship with President Nixon. Arthur Burns was a counselor in the White House. So there was a lot of influence of Chicago school, and neither Herb, Paul, or for that matter, Hautacker, none of them were at all hostile to Chicago school kind of thinking in monetary and fiscal matters.
At this point, the St. Louis model also provided a way of breaking nominal output growth down into real output growth and inflation, and then through an Okun's law from going from real output growth to the unemployment rate. So you offered that as a forecast also?
Well, that was mostly Anderson and Carlson, and definitely reflected their underlying Keynesian framework and the Minnesota School influence that I think continued. They never did quite escape from that way of thinking about things, but broke down, as you say, through an Okun's law kind of a relationship, not only the nominal spending. Nominal spending came from money growth and the money demand velocity relationship. And then also they would use a Fisher equation to break down the nominal interest rates into a real and an inflation premium component. Mm-hmm. These were those kind of things. I'm not sure now, looking back on it, how constructive they were. What happened inadvertently was that we wound up giving what I now think of some fairly naive policymakers what they thought was an alternative handle for conducting short-run, discretionary, highly activist monetary policies.
Right.
And once they started jiggling those levers and didn't get the kinds of engineering precision that they were all hoping for, then they became disillusioned with what they thought of as being monetarism. Somebody at the time, I think Henry Kaufman, had labeled it pragmatic monetarism or something. We had a couple more bouts later of pragmatic monetarism too, but
yeah, I think that's a good way to summarize it. Were you involved at all in the 1065 forecast in 1970 with Arthur Laffer? And
no, Art did that on his own because he was at OMB staff
right
at that time, and that was a part of what's called the Troika process, putting
right
together a set of numbers. Art now likes to point to the fact that after many, many revisions, many years later, turns out he was right.
So when did you, when did the trips you made to Washington, when were they? Were those in 69 then?
69.
I see. So you weren't involved in the forecast for 1971.
Well, by the end of 69, I was in exile from research, running data processing, planning, accounting, data system stuff for St. Louis Bank for a couple of years, spent a couple of years in operations. I had nothing to do with really what became known as the Anderson-Carlson model for those forecasting exercises. St. Louis said for a couple of years there, even put out alternative forecasts, they were called, in their publications. They weren't forecasts because all they were extrapolations of the implications of a framework given steady-state money growth. And you usually would have three alternatives, a 3%, 6%, or 9% narrow money growth, and holding all else constant, here's what kind of nominal GDP would be associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it tended to be portrayed in the press as those these were forecasts in the same sense as to what the econometric modeling firms and private business forecasters and others were putting out. And they compared very poorly with those, and so ultimately they were abandoned because they were being misunderstood.
Mm-hmm. So starting in 1970, you were not. There were several years where you were not involved in the regular working of the research department.
Yes, because when I finished my tour up in operations, I was only back in the research department a few months, and I went off to Germany to work for the Bundesbank for a while. And so I wasn't active in the department until the summer of 72. And by then, Homer was retired, and Andy was the director of research, and I was the number two in research.
When were you at the Bundesbank?
I went there in the fall of 71 and back in the summer of 72.
This is just slightly off the subject, but I want to ask, since you were there, at that point, had it become clear from the top down at the Bundesbank the monetary consequences of pegging to the dollar, absorbing dollars, letting the German money growth expand and inflation, and were they thinking in terms of monetary control and somehow debating how to reconcile Bretton Woods with control of domestic inflation, or was there still a lot of intellectual confusion about what they were doing at the time?
Well, it was certainly a lot of intellectual confusion, so there was an opportunity to have an influence. The reason I was invited was because they did recognize that they were importing U.S. inflation. Their devaluation of revaluation upwards of the Deutsche Mark in 1969
yes
was a reflection of their dissatisfaction with U.S. economic policies, and they would all, by that point, they were already using the term, they and the Swiss and a few others, that the United States was exporting its inflation as a result of the Great Society Vietnam programs. That caused a breakdown of the Germans' what they called free liquid quotas, free liquid reserves and liquidity quotas methods, which is an analogous to free reserves
mm-hmm.
That we had also in the Bretton Woods period. I arrived there. there shortly after Nixon had floated the dollar and closed the gold window, and I was there during the period that the so-called Smithsonian Agreement was negotiated to try to re-establish a Bretton Woods system. But the Germans were particularly interested in what they later labeled central bank money. We were calling the monetary base. Milton Friedman had called it high-powered money. Tobin had called it demand debt of the government sector. Brunner and Meltzer had called it the source base, mm-hmm. extended base. It had a lot of different names over time.
Yeah.
And we gave it the name monetary base. And the Germans, we helped them develop the balance sheets so that they could construct and develop data series and do some empirical research with what they called central bank money.
Oh, in terms of the origin of terms, what's the origin of the term monetarism? That came out of the St. Louis Fed in...
July 1968, Carl Brunner used it in a paper where he talked about two rival conceptions of how government policies influence the macroeconomy, and we used the labels monetarist and fiscalist to summarize those two frameworks.
Did you maintain close relations with Andy Anderson through this period that you were not in the research department, or did you...
I had very little contact with research then because I was an operations officer and very little time to think about economics except attend occasional seminars.
So,
but most of what he did with Berger, Carlson, half the staff probably of articles that he worked on during that period of time, Michael Kieran, I was not involved in.
Can I ask you about the meeting that Anderson attended, and later there was the flap with Fortune magazine, and whether Arthur Burns called the White House. Did you have any involvement with kind of the briefings on that meeting or discussions, or you were just out?
No, if it occurred at all, it happened in 72 while I was in Germany, but later, I do recall from the time Arthur Burns said something along the line of, it never happened, and I'm going to find out who leaked, which is an interesting pairing of phrases.
Yeah.
And he did have an FBI investigation. There were a lot of people interviewed who were attending meetings or briefings around that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Andy Rose later either said or wrote or that it was there was no single source, that the origins of the story came from, I think it was a Boston Fed conference, one of the ones they were running at either Baltic or Nantucket,
mm-hmm.
and there was a dozen or two dozen Fed people attending the conference, as there frequently are, and he was able to piece together a story that characterized a situation. And I don't know, I don't recall now whether he, in his article, used quote marks or claimed that there was the infamous phone call or anything like that, but rather the idea of the White House concerns were very much a factor in policy in 71 and 2 during the controls period. Formal vote so that all 12 presidents could participate in for the record, as well as the seven governors.
This would have been the final directive. This would have been the meeting in March of 1976. Is that the time frame, or was it
earlier? No, it was earlier than that, because I was gone by 76. And in the discussion, and by 76 we already had concurrent resolution 133, so this was well before that. And
right.
It was the 19, there were four alternatives that were being debated by the committee. One of them was a flat-out reserve aggregate money linkage of open market operations to economic activity.
This was probably in March of 1972 then.
Yeah, about that. Well, it couldn't have been March 72 because I was in Germany. And then there was three essentially money market conceptions that were put forward. So you had four alternatives, and three of them were some variation of working working on the price axis, mm-hmm. and only one of them working on the quantity axis. And the vote came down to, indication of preference came down to 7 people in favor of the one that operated on the quantity axis, and 4, 4, and 4 of the 3 alternatives that operated on the price axis. So Arthur Burns declared that clearly 12 people were opposed to the one operating on the quantity axis, even though it had a plurality, and so he ruled it as having been eliminated, and only the others would be considered. And all the rest of the discussion from that point was only on price axis approaches for implementing monetary policy. One of the people I'm pretty sure was at that meeting was Mark Willis, representing Philadelphia Fed at that time. He may have been substituting for Eastburn at that time, but I do remember Mark, if I've got the right meeting in mind, being at that meeting.
So the operating variable ruled out probably would have been reserves available to support private deposits?
No, it was a total reserve. I'm not sure we were that precise, because RPDs was actually a subterfuge all along. We never had the data to compute the damn thing for 3 weeks afterwards. But for about a year and a half, Arthur liked to play this game of saying we were using reserves available for private deposits as an instrument of monetary policy. But it never was true. It couldn't be true, because under lag reserve accounting framework, we didn't have the ability to control the thing.
Right.
But it gave the press something to chew on and took attention away from whatever it was they were really doing and tried to have the appearance of making it all coherent, more so than it was. I think that this may have been the Morris effort, and it was just a straightforward total reserves to money, to reservable money, probably a narrow money. I don't think at that time they were still willing to talk about or include the monetary base. And so I think it was a total reserves to M1 to nominal GDP kind of a linkage.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Was that meeting, there were several reports on the subcommittee on the directive. Was this before you went to Germany or after?
I don't remember that.
Okay, well, I can probably figure it out from the minutes. Well,
if you don't find the Morris piece, I